With sports car racing news and analysis from around the globe, this is the Double Stint Podcast. Here's John DeGeese, Ryan Marine, and Dan Lloyd.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Double Stint, Sports Car 365 Sports Car Racing Podcast in Indianapolis. I'm Ryan Marine. John DeGeese is in Chicago. We'll be hearing from Dan Lloyd in the UK here shortly, as we have a lot of racing to recap from over the weekend with SRO America racing at Road America, the Fanatec GT World Challenge Europe powered by AWS Sprint Cup at Brands Hatch, and then lots of news to get to on the show, plus listener questions as well. We'll start with you, John. You were up in Road America, as was I, for the weekend, and we'll focus our efforts here discussing the Fanatec GT World Challenge America powered by AWS races, a pair of them over the weekend at Road America. And I think for me, at least, the biggest takeaway from the weekend was this was the first time we've really seen weakness out of K-Pax racing all season long. Even still, they had good results in both races, including an overall win in the first race of the weekend, but it was not as straightforward as it has been for the bulk of the season.
Yeah, it was an interesting one because we saw this in a couple of the instances in race two of the week of previous weekends where maybe they're not as strong, but then they sort of come into things. And we saw it, quite frankly, again with the number three and six cars, Lamborghinis, both getting podium finishes in all four races, actually, over the weekend, with Andrea Caldarelli and Jordan Pepper winning on race one on Saturday. And Sunday ended up being the Turner Motorsport duo of Robbie Foley and Michael Dinan breaking through after some late misfortune for Windward Racing. But going back to your question about K-Pax, yeah, I think they definitely were struggling at Road America. It helped that they were in a pro environment because there's only four of those cars. And quite frankly, three of them, well, you could say all four are pretty well matched in terms of the driver lineups. I was going to say the Michael Dinan and Robbie Foley combo isn't quite as strong, but they proved it otherwise on Sunday. So it's still not as competitive. You know, when you put the amateurs in the pro-am car, they are obviously at a disadvantage. So there's ground to be gained on that part, especially in the second half of race two when the AMs are put in for that stint. So we saw it again on Sunday with K-Pax sort of consolidating and recovering from what was not a sort of an uncharacteristic weekend in some regards, but they're still the championship leaders. And it was an interesting dynamic for sure.
Definitely. I think you brought up a couple of good points there, and I'll get to the Michael Dinan conversation in a second. But one thing I thought was quite interesting on the K-Pax side, which does speak to the fact that even they internally felt like this was a more difficult weekend than maybe the ultimate results would indicate. I think it was Andrea Caldarelli telling us on the TV broadcast that, you know, it's not the Lamborghini, it's not the BOP, because we saw the TR3 car with Giacomo Altoe in race two set the fastest lap of the race. There had been some thought earlier in the weekend that maybe it just was a case that the Lamborghini or the BOP wasn't quite to their advantage, but clearly that wasn't the total answer because other Lamborghini teams did have some pace.
Yeah, and that was quite some frank comments coming out of Andrea, a Lamborghini factory driver. So, it's hard to pin down exactly, but when you think of it, you know, some days teams are going to be off. They're not going to be at 100%, and this team for so many years has been one of the top dogs, and you know, they could have an off weekend, even though, you know, that's a pretty rare occurrence. And I think they really salvaged the best they could, certainly from a championship perspective.
That's right. I think all credit to K-Pax for showing their quality, because even on a bad weekend, we're talking about podiums for everybody and a race win. So really, there's still a lot to be pleased with from Darren Law's perspective, and they'll go back to work. I think they've got a test coming up ahead of Watkins Glen to help prepare for that. But I think you brought up a good point. I mean, early in the season, the discussion between the four pro class entries was the two from K-Pax. The driver lineups were stellar. I think we were a little less sure about just how good of a lineup across the board we would see from Windward, with Russell Ward being the full season driver there. He's had a couple different co-drivers, who is very fast and gaining experience, but certainly is not the kind of doesn't have the kind of experience that a factory driver from K-Pax would, and very similar for Michael Dinan. He had never been in a GT3 car before this year, and I found myself in the broadcast over the weekend alluding to those two being of lesser experience, but almost catching myself because they've proven themselves, both of them, to be quite capable, and week in and week out it seems like they continue to improve, and I think in the second half of this season now, that makes those other two teams, Windward and Turner, a bigger part of the picture.
Yeah, and we saw that over the weekend with Russell running very strongly as he has in the last few races, and Michael really impressive. I think the BMW was really well suited to Road America as one of the cars known for its top speed and fast cornering abilities. But still, I think it really showed how he's come on as a driver. So I think this Pro class is going to be exciting the rest of the year, even though it looks like it's probably in the three cars' hands. Things can always change, and we, you know, there's always surprises around the corner.
What has been thrilling throughout the season, I think, has been the Pro-Am battle, because the Wright Motorsports team has been the most consistent with Jan Heyland and Fred Pordad, but there have been a number of different teams that have jumped up and gotten wins at various times. And we had another first-time winner over the weekend, race one with Racers Edge Motorsports. Taylor Hagler and Dakota Dickerson won that race. And it was an unpredictable weekend in a lot of respects in that class, as we've seen for the bulk of the season.
Yeah, right from the beginning of the weekend, we had an accident by George Kurtz that ultimately saw that car being withdrawn from the remainder of the event. Colin Brown had put the car on the top of the timesheets before the accident, so we knew that car was going to be a contender had that unfortunate accident not happened. And then just looking at the rest of the contenders in Pro-Am, like you said, it was great to see Racer's Edge break through for their first class win of the year with Taylor Hagler and Dakota Dickerson. Dickerson started on the overall pole in race two and showed to be really strong. But ultimately, that car ended up having an issue of some kind with its left front, I believe. Or was it right front?
It was the left front. No, it was the right front. front it was. Yes, and actually I talked to Ryan Eversley, who's part of the driver coaching lineup for Racer's Edge in their GT3 Academy, the HPD GT3 Academy, which provided the drivers effectively for this car, and he said it was a suspension issue first, which kind of compounded itself as Taylor tried to limp around, and that was a real shame because Dakota certainly starting on the overall pole, like you talked about, and Taylor Hagler in her first season of GT3 racing is coming on strong in the second half of the year too.
Yeah, I'd agree with those statements for sure, because I thought that car was definitely going to be en route for potentially an overall, maybe second or third. I think, you know, we did see Taylor lose the lead briefly before her accident, so it was probably looking on track for another overall podium, but I think Pro-Am has shown to be a lot of diversity and a lot of different winners. Consistency has really played to the game of the Wright Motorsports duo of Fred Pordad and Jan Heyland. Them just obviously being there at the end of the race, having that consistency, really does pay dividends.
Yeah, they're yet to finish off the class podium. They ended up the beneficiaries of Hagler's misfortune and picked up their second win of the season in class in race two. Couple other notes. It was good to see a second AM class car after the AF Corsa team had basically run unopposed all season long. So that was a nice bonus. It was good to see Martin Fuentes back in the series, stepping into the other TR3 car that had been run by Giacomo Altoe and Ziad Gondor earlier in the season. And finally, I'd like to give a big shout out to Ian Lacy Racing. I thought race two in particular, Drew Stavely looked really strong. That team has struggled stepping up to GT3 racing with the Aston Martin, but this weekend they looked really good. And the amazing thing is they did not do any testing at Road America. Many of their opponents had, and this is the best weekend they've had to this point.
Yeah, and I'm sure they're getting a lot of data from Aston Martin, too. There's some great support stateside by CSJ Motorsports, and there's an embedded Aston Martin engineer at most of the events. Obviously, the car has done races in IMSA competition, but not on the Pirelli tire at Road America. So not sure how much of that translates over, but still great to see that team starting to come into form.
So it was a busy weekend of racing at Road America, not just GT World Challenge America, of course, but Pirelli GT4 America, as well as GT America, powered by AWS, and TC America, powered by the Skip Barber Racing School, all at Road America. Found myself saying America a lot on the broadcast, but wasn't any way around that one, I'm afraid. No such problems for Dan Lloyd, though, who joins us now. He was at the Fanatec GT World Challenge Europe Sprint Cup race. That, of course, also powered by AWS. That would have been at Brands Hatch. I guess not at the event, but following from afar and providing the coverage for us at Sports Car 365. No shortage of drama packed into two races, both on Sunday. And amazingly, even with a couple of races still to go on the calendar, Dan, we know our Sprint Cup champions.
Yeah, so unfortunately, a second vaccine appointment got in the way of me being able to attend the Brands Hatch races. It was a bit of a shame I couldn't make it, actually, because there was some great action on offer. Brands Hatch is a pretty unique circuit for the sort of European, let's say, GT3 teams and cars. We had two really exciting races with late drama in both, which we'll touch on in a second. But in the end, it all went the way of WRT, with Dries Van Tor and Charles Wirtz wrapping up their second straight driver's title. They won the championship last year, but this year they didn't even need to take it to the final round. It was all sealed up with a couple of podium finishes. They were helped by incidents in front of them, but really it was all about keeping it clean and keeping it at the sharp end of the field. It was really impressive stuff. Almost noteworthy in how unnoteworthy some of their drives were. They just kept their noses clean and were consistently quick. I don't think they led a session all weekend, but they were certainly there and banked the points when it mattered. And certainly in the second race, when Charles Wirtz was closing in on the top two, battling Mercedes AMGs, it was obvious that he knew that he didn't have to fight them. In the end, he managed to pick up second position due to a puncture for the leading car. That was enough for them to secure the championship, and they're going to have a bit of a celebratory weekend, I think, at Circuit Ricardo Tormo in Valencia, which hosts the final round next month.
Let's talk about the drama at the end of the races, and really it starts in race one, and that's where the possibility really started to emerge that Van Tor and Wirtz could potentially clinch a championship because of what happened on track, and then ultimately what happened post-race.
Yeah, so the way things were happening at the end of the first race, they were actually, their championship lead had taken a little bit of a nibble. It wasn't anything for them to worry about, but they essentially lost 4.5 points to the number 88 Acura ASP Mercedes crew of Raffaele Marcello and Timur Boguslavski. However, a penalty for the number 88 car for its role in a late incident resulted in a swing of 16.5 points in the favour of the WRT crew, because they inherited the victory and Acura ASP lost their points because they got a penalty, a 40-second penalty that dropped them outside the top 10. So that was a real momentous moment in the championship, and is what enabled them essentially to take the crown, or at least have an easier route towards it in the second encounter. But that's the incident we'll talk about, because that sort of was the main talking point of the weekend. We had the Jota McLaren initially taking pole, getting a two-place grid drop, but Ben Barnacote made an awesome opening stint, built up a big lead to hand the car over to Ollie Wilkinson. From there on, though, Wilkinson was defending his position from Raffaele Marcello, who's obviously one of the fastest GT3 drivers out there. And I did feel for Ollie seeing the gap sort of gradually come down and down and down, because Marcello had absolutely smelt blood, and he was really not only for the championship points at stake, but also to get a first win of the season for that car. He was really keen. In the end, it came down to an incident which I'm sure many of our listeners probably would have seen. They tangled with 5 minutes remaining whilst negotiating some back markers at the very tough far end of the circuit. And unfortunately, Wilkinson's car ended up going off, and not only off, but over the barriers. There are some really frightening images of his green, white and red McLaren in the bushes beyond the outer perimeter. It was really remarkable, and just fantastic to see that Ollie was able to walk away. And I think he posted on social media he was feeling a bit sore afterwards. understandably so. And even more fortunately, they were at a section of track where spectators are not allowed to stand. So there was sort of no threat there from that perspective, and no marshals in the immediate vicinity. So I think we were very lucky there not to have a more serious accident. But the result was a penalty for Marcello. They got a 40-second added to their race time, and as a result, it set WRT on its way to pick up the title in the second race.
Yep, and so, like you said, it was a matter of keeping the nose clean there in race number two, and ultimately, there really wasn't a whole lot given the pace of the WRT car and that the ACA ASP pairing could do. They were doing just about everything in their power before misfortune struck again.
Oh yeah, they had a great race, and this was really okay. There was you could debate the incident with the McLaren as much as possible, but this was sheer bad luck in the second race for ACA ASP, because Marcello dominated from pole, as you might expect him to do. I always think that an angry driver is the fastest driver in the field, and he was certainly in a particularly bad mood after his penalty in the opening race, which only occurred a few hours before, because both these races happened on Sunday, and he cleared off into the distance, and it was almost a repeat of race one the way it panned out, because Boguslavski was given a large lead by Marcello, but he had the TalkSport WRT Mercedes closing in with Lucas Stoltz behind the wheel. Mauro Engel started it, and Stoltz brought the gap down in a similar fashion to how Marcello closed in on Wilkinson in race one. Stoltz, though, seemed to be a little bit more careful. He wasn't in as much of a hurry to work his way through. And the TalkSport guys, Stoltz and Engel, haven't had the most luck this season in Sprint Cup or in GT Masters, where they also share a car. So I think he was sort of just holding on and waiting a bit, and perhaps not even really putting his nose up the inside for any moves for the victory. But he didn't need to, because Boguslavski picked up a puncture. Not really sure where it came from, to be honest. Perhaps he was hitting some of the inside curbs too much. It happened on the front right. Either way, it was on the final lap. Boguslavski, less than half a lap to go, denied a first win of the season, and he ended up finishing sixth. And, Wirtz just drove through and took second behind Stoltz, and that was it. There's the championship sealed. And in the end, WRT didn't really need to push for a win in both races. They ended up benefiting quite a lot from others' misfortune, and as a result, they earned the title. But hey, that's how you win championships these days, I think.
Yeah, definitely a lot of good things breaking their way, but they took care of their business too. Unfortunately, not so much luck for the Jota team. You mentioned the heavy crash in race one. It was a quick turnaround because of both races running on the same day. Jota could not run in the second race of the weekend, which was a real shame, and it might have a trickle-down effect. It's still very early, but we know that just this weekend there's going to be an Endurance Cup round at the Nürburgring, and it goes to show, with such a compacted schedule here, not just in this championship but in many others, that just one little piece of misfortune can really carry over and affect a good chunk of an entire season.
Yeah, definitely. And I suppose one of the silver linings that Jota might be able to take is that their shop is the closest one to Brands Hatch. I mean, they're less than half an hour's drive away. So that maximizes the amount of time they can spend working, but there really isn't much time to spend working. I still don't, at the time of recording, I still don't fully know what their plans are for the Nürburgring now. I would assume they're in close contact with McLaren in order to source a new chassis, because the car looked pretty bad when it came back on the flatbed truck. It's a real tight turnaround, and we wouldn't have had this turnaround if we played to the original calendars. And let's not forget, Brands Hatch was initially supposed to take place at the start of the season in a back-to-back with Manicor, but it was moved onto this August bank holiday weekend. So a tight gap that might not have been there to start with. Okay, it's all what might have been, but yeah, either way, it's a tough schedule for Jota. It's tough for any British team to head over onto continental Europe with current restrictions, and so they're facing a real task to get ready for the Nürburgring. We've got 44 cars on the grid for this one, which is the penultimate round of the Endurance Cup season, and the first one after the 24 hours of Spa. And certainly lots of things going to be going on this weekend, I think. It's always a great weekend at the Nürburgring.
Well, last thing to wrap up, everything that took place at Brands Hatch, there were several classes. We've been focusing at the fight at the front, but some of the other classes they're racing as well. What were your takeaways outside of the fight for the overall win and championship?
Well, we had, as you said, the overall championship wrapped up, but it's still open in silver and pro-am heading towards the closing two races of the season at Valencia. Silver Cup, we had a win for Team WRT with Frank Bird and Riachiro Tomita, ending up on the overall podium in their Audi. They've been quite an impressive pairing. But there have been several good pairings in Sprint Cup, and it's rare for anyone to sweep a weekend. Hence, they didn't, because we had TalkSport WRT taking the silver win in the second race. Yusso Puhaka and Oscar Tunjo beating Bird and Tomita by a whisker to take the win there. And in Pro-Am, it was a sweep. It was Barwell Motorsport, the Lamborghini team, winning twice on home soil. Miguel Ramos and Henrique Chavez staking their claim to a championship bid. They're now leading the championship and managed to eke out a bit of an extension with their race two victory. But it is all to play for in those classes. It's just because the pro category is wrapped up and sealed doesn't mean that there's nothing to play for at the final round, which will be a new circuit for many of these teams. Valencia joining the Sprint Cup schedule for what is always exciting, going to a new track. But Brands Hatch, a great weekend. It was great to see a good crowd there. It was a busy weekend of British racing because on the bank holiday there was MotoGP at Silverstone and British touring cars at Thruxton. So it was great to see that there is still a lot of interest in international sports car racing in the UK. Been starved of it really recently with the Endurance Cup no longer going to Silverstone, and the same for the WEC. So it's great that we were able to see a good event here with lots of spectators enjoying some great and exciting racing action.
Check out all of Dan's coverage up at Sportscar 365. Dan, thanks so much for the insight. I suspect we'll be talking to you again next week to look back on the next Endurance Cup race at the Nürburgring.
Pleasure. Thank you, Ryan.
John DeGee's back with us as we turn our attention from the racing over the weekend to the news from this past week. And finally, John, the long-awaited announcement from Cadillac has come through. We know officially GM will be involved in prototype racing with an LMDH program, and we know the two partner teams as well, Action Express Racing and Chip Ganassi Racing.
Yeah, it came through just as we were publishing this podcast on Tuesday of last week. Had heard that was probably the case, but considering how many times they called it off at the last minute, there was no way we were going to pre-record our show on Monday saying that it was going to be announced, because I've had the story prepped for so long. I wasn't going to believe anything until it was actually in my inbox. So, yes, it is official now that Cadillac is in LMDH. They will have a dual program in the WEC and IMSA. It's believed that it's Chip Ganassi that will be running the WEC program, as well as having an IMSA car alongside Action Express with one car in IMSA. Interesting thing is Gary Nelson, the team director of Action Express, has come out and said that they have intentions of taking part in the 24 Hours of Le Mans as well, entry pending. Gary and Chad Knaus were both among the visitors to Le Mans over the course of the week there earlier this month. So certainly we're looking at it from that perspective, and just great to finally get the news out there. And that rendering, I think it caught a lot of people by surprise with no rear wing on that car. We'll have to wait and see if that's just an artist's depiction or if this is a real thing in LMDH in addition to LMH.
Yeah, that's a great point. And you wonder if that's something that was even on the radar before Peugeot put out renderings of its car. It's one of the good questions. One of the other questions is, what took so long to announce this, and why last Tuesday of all times? It seems very strange not to use all the attention surrounding Le Mans and going a couple of days later. I don't know if we have an answer to it. Have you been able to ordain any possible strategy behind it?
The only reason I was given why they ultimately didn't announce it at Le Mans was they were unable to assemble a crowd of journalists. I guess that was the request of GM initially, that they wanted to have, you know, a large turnout to show some pictures and B-roll of the mass media in attendance. And with all the COVID protocols at Le Mans, that was not possible. We had access to a hospitality suite, basically, where there was a maximum of six journalists allowed in the room. So it wouldn't have been able to orchestrate such a unveiling of any sort in Le Mans. I think the pressure ultimately got to them where they needed just to put it out finally after getting so many questions asked. I know Laura Clouser was getting bombarded all weekend long from the media just about the Cadillac program, and I'm sure she was getting the same questions from the ACO too. So I think maybe wiser heads prevailed and finally just decided to put the news out. I don't really know what the latest round of holdups were for, other than like what I said about the, you know, announcement being in front of a large group of media. But quite frankly, they weren't going to get that in any U.S. race later in the year either, as the media turnout is quite slim these days in IMSA. So, yeah, it's good that it's news is finally out there and maybe clearer heads prevailed.
Well, it is welcome news, if nothing else. Even if we kind of knew this was coming, really good to see. What do we make of the intentions to have a WEC aspect to this program? Is that simply to fulfill some requirements to guarantee a spot at Le Mans on the invitation list in the future?
Yeah, that's certainly the idea, because Cadillacs are not sold all around the world. And I think that this is clearly a program with Le Mans in mind. And the ACO has made it clear that you need to do at least a few races before Le Mans in order to get that invite. Quite frankly, it's down to the balance of performance, too. You know, the car is going to have to go to the Sauber wind tunnel to get verification. It'll also have to do some dyno testing and BOP testing and whatnot. So I think that it makes sense to have to just commit to a full season program. We believe it's a full season program. Again, it's nothing 100% confirmed on the Ganassi side, but that's the way we interpret it right now. Hopefully some more clarification to follow, but nonetheless, I think that was the reason for the WEC program. It'll be interesting now because Acura has equal aspirations to go to Le Mans under the Honda banner, under what would be the Honda banner there, although they haven't come out and said made any kind of inclination of doing WEC races. So that's the next question to see, you know, what other manufacturers, American-based LMDH manufacturers, what are they going to have to do in order to get into the big race in France in 2023?
Interesting. So watch this space for more there. And for more information on the Cadillac program, check out the story, which also includes the rendering John made reference to. That's up at sportscar365.com. From GM's prototype aspirations to the GT side of things, Corvette, as always, very much in the news and quite possibly the most positive sound bites or quotes that I've heard out of GM about the GT3 future of their Corvette came in the story that you had discussing some of the big races that might now be open to Corvette when they go the full GT3 route here in a couple of years.
Yeah, Laura Clauser was, again, talking about the possibilities. Nothing's confirmed from Corvette on GT3, but the way she was talking about it made it almost sound like it is a done deal, and what we understand is a done deal as well, but politics and announcement schedules and whatever will preventing people from talking 100% confirmed programs. But basically this story, you know, puts the prospects out there that Corvettes could be out there in mass around the world, taking part in major races and in GT World Challenge Europe and in Asia once that restarts, taking part in the Bathurst 12-hour or Total Energy's 24 hours of Spa. So there's certainly a lot of possibilities out there for this car, which we believe will debut in 2024. GM's going to have to provide a full support network for it. You know, it's not an easy task starting from scratch, more or less. They might have some existing connections with Labra in Europe, but in terms of having a parts truck at most of the races that these cars are going to be at and stuff like that, it's going to take a lot of work. But it sounds like they're committed. It sounds like they want to fully embrace GT3 finally after all these years, even with the Cadillac ATS-V that bared a GT3 emblem at first on it. It was not really a GT3 program in essence because GM refused to sell to customers. So it's interesting times at GM for sure, and hopefully we'll get confirmation on all of this maybe sometime this month, next month.
Another interesting prospect involving GT racing and GM is possibly even electric GT. What have you heard from Laura about that?
Yeah, she signaled some interest in the electric GT championship that the FIA is putting together. It's slated for a 2023 launch. We think it's more likely going to be 2024, maybe even later. But this is based around GT3, so it actually works out quite well in GM's favor if they were to go into the GT3 realm. Laura said if this is something, if electric GT does get, you know, pique their interest enough, it will be something later on that they'll look at. So that sort of does go consistent with the Corvette timeline, and it could serve as a good marketing tool because there's supposed to be a hybrid Corvette in the pipeline called the E-Ray. Of course, it won't be a fully electric Corvette, but maybe something could be come close to that, and we could see an electric race version of a Corvette compete in this electric GT in the future. So something to keep an eye on for sure.
It's interesting. It sounds strange, I have to say, the idea of an electric Corvette, but maybe that's the way the world is headed. And interesting to hear that there might be some alignment there with GT3 possibly, likely, in the future for GM, and that being the foundations for electric GT. So we shall see. To some other news regarding prototypes, we had some quotes in a story from Dan Lloyd about Peugeot and the development of the new hypercar that they are working on, and it's a compressed timeline, very aggressive in a lot of respects, but sounds like at least for now everything is on track to be able to unveil and race and test that car as they initially scheduled.
Yeah, the rollout is still scheduled for later this year. They say they're on time for the delivery of the first monocoque midway through next month. So they're really working on a time frame to get this car on track as soon as possible. We know they haven't committed to what the extent of their 2022 program will be, other than that they will race in 2022. I have a feeling they may be taking a bit of a Glickenhaus approach and maybe doing a lot of testing and development before homologating the car and having it go race. So it wouldn't surprise me to see if they skip the first race of the season at Sebring, maybe debut at Spa or Le Mans, or maybe even skip Le Mans next year if they don't feel that they're in a position with the car, because once you lock in the homologation, it's good for the full 5 years, and you only get one Evo update in between. So it's a real crucial phase, especially with all these other manufacturers coming in both LMH and LMDH. So yeah, it's good to see that everything's on time, but at the same time, we don't know exactly when they'll be out racing in 2022.
Still a lot of work to go. Some really interesting quotes in that story. You can find them up on the website. And final topic of news for discussion, some thoughts from TF Sport, Tom Farrier's team, about perhaps testing themselves in a pro class with a single entry, kind of on a one-off basis in major endurance races, where frankly Aston Martin is a bit underrepresented here in recent years as far as the pro class is concerned. Plenty of customer Astons out there, but this is a team that's been ultra competitive and successful racing at the customer level and in the pro-am level, and interesting to hear that they have interest in trying to see what they could do going up against some of the best of the best.
Yeah, this was an interesting development for sure. We saw Garage 59 run an all-pro Aston Martin at the Total Energies 24 Hours of Spa and ended up on the podium there with Nikita and Marco Sorensen and Ross Gunn. And that sounds like Tom Farrier's group is looking for something similar, potentially for Le Mans next year with the GTE variant of the Aston Martin. So we'll have to wait and see what happens. We know Aston is fully supportive of a customer program like this as long as the budget comes externally. Aston doesn't have the budget to run a car themselves. That's why they pulled out of factory competition at the end of last year. But nonetheless, I think that there's a good chance we probably could see this for Le Mans next year with TF, and that would be a great sight.
More on those stories and a whole lot more, of course, up at sportscar365.com. Time to get to your questions now, and quite a few of them came in on the heels of the 24 Hours of Le Mans and the reaction to it in the last week or so. Shay Samuels has a question regarding Jim Glickenhaus' statements regarding manufacturer validity for IMSA selling 2,500 vehicles and how that might infringe on U.S. antitrust laws. Shea says, from my research on the topic, by the letter of the law, he seems to make a fair and valid point. However, do you see any challenge of this coming or even making a difference to the IMSA governing body? It seems that IMSA has very much muscled out smaller constructors to the point where, Shea says, I cannot really remember a time in my life when it wasn't just the big OEMs racing. Shea says, I'm only 24 years old. And yeah, that really has been the case in recent years, with maybe the exception of the Delta Wing coming to mind.
Yeah, then that was an exception made because Dr. Don Panos was the vice chairman of IMSA at the time. Mm-hmm. So the question is whether this has legal precedence or not. I don't really know, and I don't want to speculate. I think that's the biggest thing about this. You know, I see Jim's points. I see them clear. I see IMSA's points pretty clear, too. And I don't want to say one way or another whether this could make a legal matter. I know Jim potentially could be pursuing something like this, but we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, that's not really an area of expertise as far as the legal stuff goes. So I'm not going to be able to offer a whole lot of insight to maybe the better place to go with this just is to talk about the two viewpoints for those that aren't familiar with it. Jim Glickenhaus would love to compete in the big U.S. races with his car. IMSA, though, has this longstanding approach of wanting pure manufacturer involvement in its series. And can you help talk us through why that might be and what they've done to this point to kind of make it be that way?
Yeah, when the two series merged to create the WeatherTech Championship in 2014, IMSA laid out some pretty firm rules, particularly with the GT ranks, but it actually extended through all of their classes, where every manufacturer has to put up an entry fee and a marketing commitment, let's say, where they put X amount of dollars into the TV commercials or print ads or other forms of media to support their investment in the WeatherTech Championship. And that number is quite significant from what we've heard, and it varies by the manufacturer. If you're a smaller boutique manufacturer like McLaren, you're not having to put as much of an investment in if you're GM, for instance. So Glickenhaus would have had to do a smaller investment on that. But what's changed a little bit in the recent months is that IMSA has extended their requirement of road car production for LMDH/LMH cars to 2,500 units required in order for that manufacturer to even enter the championship, even if they want to put in the entry fee and the marketing spend and the automotive partnership, basically, what IMSA calls. And so Glickenhaus does not have 2,500 road cars as of now, so that would basically preclude them from even looking to contest the series. So this was a rule that was a little bit not as firm in place until recently. It actually was just added to the supplementary regulations last week, believe it or not, for LMH concerns. It was a rule in the supplementary regs for LMDH, but IMSA has only decided to enact that for all the top class prototypes until now.
Sorry.
So, it's an interesting one. Those are the facts. Let's see if anything develops in the courtroom.
Yeah, we'll keep an eye on this subject as it develops. I for one would love to see the Glickenhaus' run in IMSA, but we'll have to see if that becomes a viable option or not. The next question comes from He Who Knows, who says, the LMP2 finish at Le Mans was so crazy. Someone on YouTube said the force was strong with the flagman. In all seriousness, though, that was nearly a disaster. So what needs to change to prevent such a thing in the future? And for those who may have missed this, what is being alluded to here, as is customary, the checkered flag was waved by a flagman who was standing out on the track surface itself. The prototype race, though, was not yet complete in LMP2, meaning that there were two cars racing for the win, effectively, at the very end, and they were catching traffic that was coming across the line slowly, posing for photos and things like that, and it led to near calamity with the flagman nearly being hit by one of the two LMP2 cars that was racing to the checkered flag, effectively. I do think this needs to be looked at, John, because as cool as the tradition is, that could have been a very ugly scene.
Yeah, I don't think we'll be seeing that again. I think you'll have the flag being waved in the starter stand. Unfortunately, it goes against their traditions, but something like this will definitely not go unnoticed, and I'm sure there's already been discussions with the FIA and ACO and whatnot on what to do for next year.
Yep, exactly. So, next question from Tariq Ramchani. He actually has a couple of them. The first one, are there chances to see Corvette Racing doing the 24 Hours of Spa with a C8 GT3 in the near future? I remember the FIA GT Championship days when many fans really wanted to see them there with the C6R in GT1. And as we discussed earlier, there is that chance, and they're making all the right noises, but nothing by any means has been determined, including definitively whether or not they're going GT3 racing, although we believe that to be the case.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. Whether it'll be a full factory effort, I guess that could depend if Corvette Racing is allowed at Le Mans or not in the future. They may want to take the revenge and go on an Intercontinental GT Challenge tour or something with Corvette Racing instead. Who knows? In addition to their IMSA program, I don't know. I'm just guessing here. So we'll have to wait and see.
That's an interesting prospect I'd not considered. Interesting speculation. Let's see. Question two from Tariq. Why is there no Ferrari name in the official GTE Pro effort? It looks like a privateer entry when you just read AF Corsa, and the 488 GTEs then would just look like customer cars with works drivers, which of course they aren't. That is interesting. Why the Ferrari nomenclature, like Porsche employs other teams to run its GTE Pro team, for instance, and they would always run under the Porsche name. Why not Ferrari?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. AF Corsa has always been AF Corsa, and they started off as AF Corsa with very little Ferrari support, and they've grown with the manufacturer. So I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what happens with the hypercar. We know AF Corsa will be running the Ferrari hypercar, but LMH car, but do we know if it's going to be under the AF Corsa banner? That's an interesting one there.
Yeah, good question. Sorry, we don't have a good answer for you there, Tariq, but I hadn't really thought about that before. Edward Bighouse with our next question. Actually, it's more of a suggestion. Why not allow pro teams like Corvette in the single GT3 Plus or something, WEC GT class in 2023, via a BOP to pro cars against pro-am cars? The system works pretty well in national GT championships. I'm not entirely sure I followed this one. Have you been able to parse through this?
No. I get the idea of what he's trying to say in that, you know, you can BOP the pro cars down to pro-am levels, but I think that's probably just asking for a recipe for disaster. That's my opinion. The BOP needs to be the same between the classes, and that was one of the big things the manufacturers were pushing for in GTD Pro and GTD, and they finally got. And we see that on display in the SRO championships, even this past weekend at Brands Hatch and Road America. So I think it's really important to keep the BOP the same between the classes and just have the driver ratings speak for themselves.
I think that's right, too. And again, there's no guarantee. In fact, indications are that it's unlikely that there will be a pro class to replace GTE Pro in the near future, at least in the FIA WEC. So we'll see. If for some reason, Edward, we didn't totally understand what you were trying to say, please feel free to resubmit and help walk us through your suggestion. All suggestions are welcome, of course. One more question coming in from at Corvette1117, who says, was watching the GT World Challenge America race at Road America this weekend and noticed the Corvette bridge still has the 7th Gen logo on it. Do you think it will be changed to the new 8th Gen logo eventually? First of all, thanks for watching. Second of all, really sharp eyes. I never would have picked up on that. I suspect the answer is yes. as long as the GM sponsorship at Road America continues, I think eventually, yeah, they would want to make that change. I'm frankly a little surprised it hasn't happened already, but a really interesting note. Very, very interesting. And good eyes by you to pick that one up. One more question comes in. This one is from Roy John, who wants to know, on average, what is the average horsepower to weight in World Challenge GT4?
That's a good one. Basically, most of the cars are in the 400 horsepower range, and they weigh roughly the same as GT. Well, they're slightly heavier than GT3 cars, so about 2,800 to 3,000 pounds in Imperial. So I would say the power to weight ratio is definitely less in GT4 as it is in GT3, and I think Stefan Rattel's made the point of GT2 being a 50% power to weight ratio if you count it in kilograms. So that gives you a better idea of where GT2 is at. That means a very powerful lightweight car, but hard to handle with a gentleman driver behind the wheel.
Yes, as we've seen a few times. So thanks everyone for writing in with your questions and comments. If anybody else has questions that they would like answered or comments they would like to voice, we'd love to hear from you. You can leave a comment in the comment section from this week's podcast, or you can use the hashtag AskDoubleStint on Twitter to make sure those questions get our way, and we will address them in a future show. We do have racing coming up this weekend. Fanatec GT World Challenge Europe, powered by AWS. The Endurance Cup back in action. That will be at the Nürburgring. DTM racing at the Red Bull Ring in Austria this weekend. And Creventic back in action, the 24-hour series at the Circuit de Barcelona, Catalunya in Spain. So plenty of racing to keep you entertained over the weekend. And we'll talk a lot about that on next week's show as well. Thanks to John. Thanks to Dan. Thanks to you as well for tuning in. Talk to you next week with our next edition of Double Stint.